Arise, O God, and judge thou the earth, for thou shalt take all the nations into thine inheritance. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. Please be seated. When I was in college, my friends and I would often take day trips over the weekends over to Ann Arbor, where there was much more to do than where we attended school. And I'll never forget on one particular outing when we ran into a street preacher trying to convert the masses to Christ. Now, while I laud this man's intention and I continue to remain impressed by his courage, then as now I have serious reservations about his methods. He had above him a banner denouncing God's judgment against sinners in bold texts, and each letter had flames coming up around it. And to drive home the visual, make sure we didn't miss the point, the banner also included pictures of people also covered in flames, presumably the reprobate on their way to hell, all the people, no doubt, who were passing him on the street. This man spoke only of God's coming wrath, of his hatred of evil, of the torturous fate of the damned, and he called those bystanders who tried valiantly to ignore him to repent or else. Now, I don't deny this man's doctrine of the judgment to come. We confess as much in our creed every Sunday that Christ will, quote, come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. Where I take issue with his evangelizing strategy is where he focused most of his attention, indeed almost all of it, on God's wrath, almost exclusively to the neglect of God's love and atoning grace for sinners. For all of his talk about God's judgment against sin, which is a real thing, don't get me wrong, he never mentioned that God's judgment has been poured out on Jesus Christ when his arms were stretched out for love on the cross. Didn't get to the cross. Not sure what this man managed to accomplish. God, of course, woos us to himself by showing his Son lifted up high. Now, I bring up this story now not so much to disagree with his doctrine, but to highlight what I think is actually a common misconception among many Christians, even, alas, among those who would not share this man's particular interest in shouting denunciations on unbelievers. Because I think his basic vision of God's coming judgment, of wrath and brimstone and fire and gnashing of teeth, is how, in fact, we all tend to think about it. Now, unlike this man, we aren't so keen as much to shout it from the rooftops. Rather, we try to avoid talking about God's judgment to come altogether. But the root cause of both of these things, both the desire to shout it from the rooftops and the desire to not talk about it at all, I think the root is the same. A vision of God's coming judgment, which is something to dread more than anything else. It is a frightful thing, an awful thing, a worrying thing, to consider the judgment to come. Even the word judgment invokes almost completely judgment against evil, condemnation. So why, we must ask, does the psalmist today ask God to come and judge? He seems to relish in the prospects. He looks forward to it. He wants God to come and get it done. Look with me at verse 8, the last verse of the psalm. Arise, O God, and judge thou the earth. Arise. He's inviting God to come and judge. The whole psalm, in fact, extols the glories of God's coming judgment. In hymnic form, it encourages God's people not only to imagine it, not only to look forward to it, but to sing God's praises because of it. The psalmist's basic instinct, in fact, finds its way into our very prayer book. The preface for Advent uses these words, that when Christ shall come again in power and great glory to judge the world, we may, without shame or fear, rejoice to behold his appearing. Without shame or fear, rejoice to behold his appearing. Or perhaps this prayer, assigned to the second communion of Christmas Day. Christmas, that joyous occasion. Grant that as we joyfully receive Christ as our Redeemer, so we may with sure confidence behold him when he shall come to be our judge. Consider these choice of words, friends. Rejoice. Sure confidence. Without shame or fear. This is the proper Christian disposition to God's coming judgment. I will not say now what the proper disposition of the unbelieving masses outside ought to be. That's a whole different sermon for a whole different time. I speak now about how Christians ought to view God's coming judgment. With joy, with confidence. And the psalmist would agree. How do we get from fire and brimstone, fear and trembling, to joy and confidence without shame or fear? Why should Christians, the people of God, actually look forward to the judgment of God? Let's see if we can't take a closer look at Psalm 82 and find out the answer. Today's psalm is a hymn of praise, as I said before, for the judgment of God. It describes God taking his place in the congregation of the princes, who are described later on in verse 1 and then again later in verse 6 as gods. Now, this is surely a reference to the human rulers of the ancient world. In the ancient Near East, that time and place in which Israel lived and did their thing, the kings of Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, and the rest, all the kingdoms that surrounded them, these kings viewed themselves in quasi-divine terms. Now, while human, they enjoyed such an intimate relationship with the gods of their respective pantheons that they spoke of themselves, and their own people spoke of them, as the direct mouthpieces of those gods, the conduits through which the gods exercised their dominion over their human subjects. To oppose the king is to oppose the divine order. And we don't have to take the Bible's word for this, though that's trustworthy enough. These kings testify about it themselves in their own documents, which have survived to the present day. And so we see here the one true God taking his place among the power structures of our world. The human governments and the idolatrous regimes they represent in all of their pretentious glory. And just so we don't gloat as the people of God about all this, let's make sure we juxtapose this psalm with today's reading from the prophet Jeremiah, read for us today by a man named Jeremiah, quite appropriate, and also the gospel, where Jesus himself offers this teaching, talking not about the kingdoms of the world under God's judgment, but of the religious authorities of God's own people themselves, who presume to speak falsely for God and give his people peace where they ought to be repentant. The judgment of God comes first on the household of God. So God takes his seat among these leaders of the human peoples. And what does he see? He's not very impressed. By way of a question in verse 2, he speaks. And he condemns their failure to judge rightly and to rule justly. He judges their corruption and their favoritism for the rich and powerful. In verses 3 and 4, he damns to hell their neglect for the poor, the vulnerable, the needy, the outcasts. These who, as image bearers of the one true God, sinners notwithstanding, deserve the protection of their rights. Indeed, the earth itself trembles at the gravity of their idolatry, their injustice, their disdain for their human brethren and for the divine order, in verse 5. Their human power, as exercised, is an affront to the very laws of nature, and that nature trembles. The good Creator God, perfect craftsman that he is, can't not condemn them. God has come in judgment, and his judgment is severe, guilty as charged. Now, at first glance, this psalm may seem to reinforce our notions of God's judgment as something to dread, something to fear. But remember that the psalmist's summons for God to come and get it done comes after he has described all of this. In the very last verse of the psalm, as a sort of stamp of approval on the whole project. How do we explain this? Try considering this psalm not from the perspective of the powerful and rich elite, the privileged and comfortable few who can impose their whims on the rest of society. Rather, imagine it from the perspective of everyone else. Imagine it from the perspective of the powerless, the weak, the voiceless, the oppressed, the poor, the victims of unjust judgments and the naked power grabs of these elites. Consider this psalm from their perspective. Would you not like to receive the judgment of God then? Not guilty while your enemies are condemned. Perhaps now, looking through the lens of the oppressed, you will see why God's judgment to come is actually something to look forward to. Justice in our fallen world is rather hard to come by. Even when we are not dealing with straight-up despots and tyrants, the complexities of human life and the messiness of history make righting past wrongs and restoring past losses very difficult to even conceive, let alone actually achieve. Just think about our own nation's history with race and the difficulties we've had and the challenges we continue to have in properly atoning for it. Even the best of our public servants cannot completely and permanently stop the harm we do to one another. And if even the best can't do it, what can we expect from the mediocre and the ordinary, the kinds of politicians we tend to get most of the time? We don't need to be ruled by Hitler or Stalin themselves to see evil perpetuating itself in our broken world, even in our own nation, in our own neighborhoods, for those with eyes to see, even within our own hearts. But when God comes in power and great glory, he will not be so limited. He will establish a perfect reign of justice. Every wrong will be righted, every injustice redressed, every evil intention thwarted, every broken heart mended, every hurting soul comforted. He will wipe away every tear, and suffering and death will be no more. No more market crashes. No more global pandemics. No more greedy Ponzi schemes. No more corrupt politicians. No more mediocre politicians, for that matter. No more party faction. No more warring nations. No more genocide. No more slavery. No more grinding poverty. No more want of any kind. No more grave income disparities. No more haves and have-nots. No more biased media. No more godless academies. No more racism. No more prejudice. No more shame and fear and doubt and loneliness on all the earth. Only a perfectly ordered world, a harmoniously balanced commonwealth, a perfectly secure polis, a city of God shining on a hill, with the wealth of the nations piled high for all and to enjoy, the gates of which city are open for that wealth to be brought in day and night, and the tree of life, which our ancestors forfeited in the Garden of Eden, now restored to us in the very center of that city for all to partake. And the true worship of the living God, joyously offered up by all without reservation or hypocrisy. And all the evil in this world, all the false intentions, all the corruption, the lies, the pretensions, the power plays, the arrogance, the unchecked despotism of wickedness, all of the evil will be utterly expelled, and it will never return. Any and all practitioners of selfish sinfulness will be thoroughly winnowed out of it by God's righteous gaze. And now, my friends, does that not sound like the kind of world to look forward to? Doesn't that sound like a nation we all would like to live in? This is the world that God's coming judgment will bring, a world of peace, order, stability, and hope, a world of love and laughter and light and life. No wonder the psalmist beckons God to come down here and get on with it. But wait a minute. If all the evil intentions and selfish ambitions and idolatrous notions will be utterly expelled from this world by the holy purity of God's righteous judgment, who can survive such a winnowing? Now, here's the rub. Who among us is utterly free of any contribution to this world's mess? Please raise your hand so we can come sit and learn at your feet. Who among us does not cling in the secret corners of our hearts to those very godless desires which drive so much of this world's evil? Who among us can honestly look at our own hearts, our own prejudices, our own ignorances, in a word, our own sinfulness, and honestly wonder if we would even belong in such a pure and righteous commonwealth? If we found ourselves suddenly within it, would we feel like foreigners in a strange land? Would we rather get the heck out of there and find some place a bit more familiar, more comfortable? God invites us to a holiday at the beach. Would we rather continue with our mud pies in the alley because that's what we know? Would we even want to stay in such a righteously pure place? If God's judgment purifies the world of evil by final and unappealable fiat, who would remain alive within it? The answer, of course, is no one. Not you, certainly not me, not even the holiest person you know. None of these by themselves, by their own power or nature or self-disciplined virtue, is good enough, is pure enough, is holy enough to abide that day of righteous glory. So, are we now right back where we started? Why ought Christians to look forward to with rejoicing and sure confidence to behold Christ's glorious appearing? Why might we be called by the voice of the psalmist to invite God to arise and come to judge? Because those of us who belong to Jesus know that our rightful place in this coming kingdom has nothing whatsoever to do with our deserving it at all. God's people have not earned it. They have not merited it. Rather, it is given to them freely by Christ's blood shed on the cross and by his resurrection from the dead. All of their past wrongs have been atoned for by his spotless sacrifice once and for all. All the immortal riches of God's household have been lavishly bestowed upon them by his glorious rising. It is his victory that we relish in, friends, not our own. The people of God do not dread the day of judgment, not because they are so sure that they will pass the test. Indeed, these among all the peoples of the earth know perhaps the best that they cannot. But because they know that Jesus will stand beside them, that Christ himself will stand behind them, that God the Son, the righteous judge, will live within them. And even when we are faithless, he is faithful, because he cannot deny himself, nor can he deny all those who are in him. And so by virtue of our attachment to him, will we know that we will have the strength to stand. This is why Paul speaks in today's epistle from the 8th chapter of his letter to the Romans that God's people have not received, they have not received a spirit of bondage and fear, cowering in helpless uncertainty before his righteous judgment. They have not received this spirit. Rather, they have received God's own spirit with a capital S, whereby they are adopted into the divine household and can now call Christ the Son of God their brother and speak out to his Father as if he were our very own, for surely he is by grace, as our spirits say, Abba, Father. And this they do even when they suffer in this world, as they await his coming in power and great glory and the final resurrection of their bodies unto everlasting life. Even as God's people suffer, they cry out as adopted sons of God. And like any beloved child, a child who knows that he is beloved, they have a reasonable expectation that their good and compassionate Father, that he will hear them, that he will come to them, that he will bind their wounds and wipe away all of their tears. Such beloved children, counting not on their own righteousness, but on that freely given to them by Christ, these children of God look forward to the coming judgment of God without shame or fear, because it is in this world where they are more uncomfortable. In the kingdom to come, they will at last be home. And this truth pays great dividends for our lives now, which I cannot even begin to describe in words worthy of their grandeur. But I can say simply and quickly that God's people now will have a comfort. God's people now will have a great hope. God's people now will have a great power to love and let go of this reckless world. Those who belong to Christ now by faith have God's comfort in this world that enables them to endure and persevere and keep fighting the good fight under Christ's glorious banner with patience and humility. Those who belong to Christ by faith now have great hope that their true citizenship in kingdom to come, which will liberate them from this lustful wants and prideful vainglory of this world, a sure hope which liberates them from the fear of want, that they may live in perfect freedom come what may. Those who belong to Christ by faith now have a great love to share with the least and the lost, because they know how much they have themselves been forgiven, and they no longer live for the praises and perquisites of mere men. Oh no, these live for the glorious judgment of God. Such as these can, even in this mortal world, leave signposts of the world to come by good deeds done, signposts that reflect the culture of the kingdom to come, the radiant glory of the transforming love of God to all those God has placed around them. And so, my friends, if you want this kind of comfort, if you want this kind of hope, if you want this power to love as Christ himself loves, to live your lives free of shame and fear, to rejoice to behold Christ's appearing, I invite you to give yourselves anew to Christ today. And you will indeed on that great and glorious day, without shame or fear, rejoice to behold his appearing. Thanks be to God.